Welcome to the intersection of technology, cybersecurity, and society. Welcome to ITSP Magazine Podcast Radio. You're about to listen to an episode of Your Everyday Cyber Podcast with Limor Kesem and Diana Kelly. We live in a cyberspace almost all the time, but do we know enough about living in it securely? Join this dynamic duo as they take you through an exploration of daily cyber activities and how you can make better choices to make them secure for yourself and your family. Knowledge is power, now more than ever.
Welcome to Your Everyday Cyber. I'm Limor Kesem, cybersecurity professional and advisor. My co-host is Diana Kelly, a cybersecurity expert who is the CTO and co-founder of Security Curve. Hackers and computers that have gone awry have been a theme for movies and thrillers since HAL 9000 said, "I'm sorry, Dave, I can't do that." That was in 1968, A Space Odyssey. It seems crazy it's been so long. Yeah. Fictional works like Cryptonomicon, published in 1999, are prescient about real-world concerns like the balance between encryption, privacy, and public safety. Recent hits like Mr. Robot really prove our desire for this kind of entertainment. It's not going away anytime soon. And I do love me a science fiction movie and books. And I think, like most people that like it, I just see how they're tied to reality, or maybe reality soon to come. So don't get me started on Star Trek. That's like how this all began for me. Diane, how about you? Do you read and watch a lot of cyber thrillers maybe in your spare time?
You know, it's funny. It's probably less than people might think. I really do enjoy reading nonfiction technical books. So I spend a lot of time doing that to keep up to speed and to keep current. But I have a hard time getting through some of the fictional movies and books about cyber because they can be so out of whack with the actual tech. I mean, sometimes it feels like the author just did an online search for cybersecurity words and buzz and then just strung them all together randomly.
My God, I know what you mean. A funny story, a friend of mine and a well-known hacking persona, her name is Karen Elizari. So shout out to Karen. She actually took on some of the top movies and series, and she looked at how actually logical their cyber and tech scenes are. And it was a treat. I have to tell you, it was one of the reasons also why we wanted to bring on today's guest, who is Deb Radcliffe. She is the first journalist to ever cover cybersecurity as a beat and the author of a recently published thriller called Breaking Backbones: Information is Power. Deb, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Thank you. Deb, you've been covering cybersecurity since 1996. That's a time when most people had no idea why information security even mattered. What made you decide to focus on cyber back then?
Well, I was a police reporter for my last job at the Santa Rosa Press Democrat, and I was working there part-time when a message came out. Someone needed help working on a book about computers, no computer knowledge necessary. And the next thing I knew, I was chasing Kevin Mitnick around the country for a best-selling book by John Littman. He was on the run from the FBI and reaching out to John Littman over paid telephone. So the plan was Mitnick would call his house, let it ring twice and hang up. That was Littman's cue that he needed to get his pen and his pad of paper and go down to a payphone to pick up another call from Mitnick. This was their way of avoiding the listening devices that were on Mr. Littman's line from the FBI. When I took that assignment, it was only 12 hours later that the hacker, friends of Kevin Mitnick, found my phone number, which was unlisted. And all Littman told him was, "I have a person." He gave him my name and said, "She lives in California and she's going to be calling you to start investigating and doing research for my book." My phone number started ringing in the middle of the night. They literally came into my house. And I had kind of a scary husband at the time, and he was going ballistic over these phone calls. So I I literally pulled all the cords out of the wall so we could sleep. And then the next day I called John Littman and I said, I didn't think I could do this. These people found me in my house. I've got little kids. What should I do? So Littman went to all of Mitnick's buddies and just begged them to leave me alone because he really needed me. And the next thing I knew, I was researching that book. And actually some of Kevin Mitnick's friends were even helping me try to get online for the first time. This was 1995. So I realized then that this thing called the internet wasn't going to be going through dial-up modems for very long. They are going to have direct connections into homes and businesses. So I picked up the beat from that day forward. I did not look back. I realized Mitnick's friends could hassle anybody they wanted to. Mm-hmm. They could use social engineering to get them to do anything they wanted, give away passwords and whatnot. And that was the easy part. It was going to get even easier, though, when we had the direct internet connections, because my assumptions were you can't prove who you are on the internet, and no one's going to, know who they're dealing with on the internet. And I felt like it was going to be sheep to the slaughter. And as both of you know, it was sheep to the slaughter.
Yeah, and you were right there on the front lines when it started, Deb. It's incredible what you've seen. And in that vein, the term hacker is an interesting one because it can be used in both a positive and negative way. You spent time with a lot of the famous quote hacker groups like the Loft, who is a group from the Northeast whose members briefed the U.S. Congress about internet security, Cult of the Dead Cow, which was a group that former U.S. presidential hopeful Beto O'Rourke got his start.
Yeah, I know. Right? Funny. When I saw that, I started cracking up.
Uh-huh. All right. So based on your time with members in those communities, what does hacker mean to you? Are they good on the good side or the bad side?
So I will not grace the term hacker for a criminal. Criminals are criminals. They could be crackers, which means criminal hacker, but literally my whole career, I've written them as criminals and bad guys. I've never graced them with the term hackers. They may be hacking, but they are not hackers. Hackers are researchers. Hackers are curious. I worked with the gray hats and the white hats. The black hats are the ones that are trying to make money by hurting other people, issuing ransomware, taking down pipelines, taking down hospitals. They don't care. They're horrible people. The hackers I worked with were very curious, very colorful, really trying to make a statement, trying to make a splash, trying to get attention, trying to show the world what was coming. Starting in the 1990s, Kevin Mitnick and Kevin Paulson were held up as FBI's poster children for what not to do. Both of them were in jail for 4 years before they got their trials because the federal judges didn't know what to do with these guys. There were no criminal statutes really for computer crime, except for the 1984 Computer Crime and Intrusion Act. So they were really lost as to how to deal with these guys, and they set them up as bad guys. To me, they were gray hats. They intruded, they bragged about their intrusions, but they were not monetizing off of it. They were literally warning us. Kevin Mitnick started with the telephone companies and literally went into their areas where they kept all of their electrical and everything else. And he would open them up and literally go in and try to see how they were built. That is a hacker, not a criminal. The criminals moved in using what the hackers told us was going to happen, and they started monetizing off of it. There are gangs, there are mobs. It's the mafia out there from all over the world, and they are not hackers. They are sometimes hired by the mob to do bad things online, sometimes coerced into it, like in countries like Russia. But I don't grace them with the term of hackers. I call them criminals.
Got it.
I agree. It's like, you know, if you know how crime works, you can be a criminal, you could be a police officer. You could choose the side you want to be on. So I definitely agree with that. And Deb, now you've written a thriller about the high velocity world of cybercrime and defense, and I've read the book and loved it. It's clear you spent a lot of time making sure the tech was right. But you also built a story that's a stab all night page turner. What prompted you to shift from nonfiction and reporting to going to fiction?
Well, first of all, this story just got stuck in my head probably 15 or 20 years ago when I was listening to Scott McNeely talk about chipping his dogs. So why can't he chip his children to know where they are and keep them safe all the time? Scott McNeely at the time was the chair of Sun Microsystems. And I thought, oh, great way to drum up new business, Mr. McNeely. But more importantly, I thought, who would do that? And if they did that, what would be the privacy implications and what would be the safety implications? Would we be more at risk from other hackers hacking our chips or from a corporate or a government takeover of control? Because they'll be able to monitor everywhere we are, our heartbeat, what we're saying, maybe if it's got some kind of microphone capability in it. How could we even live a free life if we took a human chip implant? And that started me down this path, and characters started popping in my head. I've been to the defense forensics labs. I got a full day tour from Jim Christie, who headed it up. Oh, back then. He was quite a visionary, by the way, from the Department of Defense. And he, you know, showed me their evidence locker and their giant server room. And I started putting together this character named Cindy Frank. And I didn't mention this in the book, but she's actually named after a friend of mine who died, and her family said, please someday honor her in your writing. So Cindy Frank was a Department of Defense forensics investigator, a total ace investigator. But she decided to go off grid because they were forcing her to take the chip so she could come into work. She was contract, so she didn't, you know, run away on her military commission. She just left a contracting job and went off grid and helped form a clan in the Blue Ridge Mountains. The characters have the names, their personalities have been in my head for like almost 20 years. And it was almost one of those things where if I didn't get it out on paper, I was going to go crazy. And so I had a slow period starting in 2018, where I finally got it written down. My job at Sands lightened up a little bit. Instead of running the entire analyst program from soup to nuts there, I was moved into more of a creative directorship role, which was so much easier for me that I was able to really pick up on this book and start working on it again. I actually tried to sell it as a TV screenplay originally, so I do have it written in screenplay form also. And all the producers I talked to, which were very few actually, said start with a book. So I reverted back to book, and the book is out there. And now I'm on a mission to get it sold again as a screenplay.
So, Debbie, you're mentioning about chips, and you know that is as a driving force of the book. And some of us who have dogs and cats, at least in the United States, we have no option. Our dogs and cats come to us chipped already from the animal shelter when we adopt them. Do you think that that's a problem with the animals? And if it's not a problem in animals, why is it a problem in humans?
That's a good question. I actually have a line in book number two after one of the hackers takes out his human chip because he got caught and put in a camp and they chipped him. And he said that he'd managed to live his whole life without a chip and now he's being chipped like a farm animal. And that's the distinction. The animals, you know, they can run off, get lost, et cetera. And we put a collar on them and we may put a chip on the collar. I don't think it's wrong for doing that with livestock and animals because they don't really have an expectation of privacy. They're not running bank accounts. They don't have, you know, personal things they're doing that maybe they don't want people to know. Maybe they have unusual sex routines or whatever, you know. But in the human world, we have freedom of thought, we have freedom of expression, we have freedom of to go about the country if we want to. All of that would be taken away if a chip was used in the wrong way. And that's what I was really trying to portray in this story. And I really wanted people to think about what it would mean, because I do think the day is coming where, hey, you're tired of carrying your cell phone around with you everywhere to do everything with. Maybe we can put a chip in your tooth, or maybe we can put a chip in your arm and you won't have to carry your cell phone anymore. You're worried about your data. Again, we can protect that better than we can protect the 16 devices you're carrying around with you. So I feel that the day is coming and people need to think about it. I wrote it for a general audience, though, because the technology audience I write to, they get it, but they can't stop this tide of maliciousness happening no matter what they do. And they won't be able to stop a paradigm shift like a human chip implant. If anything, they'll be encouraging it because they may think it's more secure for humans as well. Mm-hmm. So I wanted the general audience to read this and understand, one, that you've got huge privacy issues coming up. If you think you had some now, wait till the future. And number two, it's a love gift to the community that I worked with and work with still all these years. These hackers are doing a lot of good work. The cyber cops and the CISOs and everybody in between are trying to solve this. They're trying to make us secure online. It's an impossible job, but how do you make that interesting? And how do you make a general audience want to read about it? So again, this story just kept coming in my head. Are they going to live in a cave? Yeah, they're going to live in a cave. Well, that's weird. Not so weird. Go look up. Lots of people actually live in caves. Okay, move on, you know? And so just kept working on it. And, you know, 2 years of development and rewriting, and it finally felt good enough to go to the publisher.
It's an amazing book, and there's so many colorful characters as well.
As you were mentioning, different people doing all this great work, and in the book, the protagonist Sai, then her wingman Desolation, some team members such as Skew and Alvin. What's with the weird names? And did you end up basing any of the characters on people you knew during your investigative work?
Great question, Lamar. Yes, almost all of them are based on people I've met in my work. And the character names are because, one, they're living off grid, so they assume a new identity. And they love hacker handles. So as you know, from The Cult of the Dead Cow, from The Loft, we had The Hobbit. So I have a character named Bilbo, and he doesn't wear shoes. And I found The Hobbit. He is out of technology now. He's into radio and DJ and music, and he's got his own music website, and he's really like doing a whole different thing. And he read it and he's like, I'm fine, whatever you want to do. Maine is a character who's still active today. His name is Del Chai, and he was with another hacking group that I hung out with at Hope 2000 was when I met him. So we go a long way back, and he's still around. He's a really big dude, man. He was big when I met him, and he has a sort of a gland problem that just makes him grow and grow. So he's now like in his late 40s and he's struggling with health issues, but he's a super smart dude. And he always reminded me of a lion because he had this plaited red hair and he wore it kind of long down to his shoulders and it kind of spread out like a lion's mane. So I called him Mane, M-A-N-E. And Desolation came up just on his own, and he sort of looks like a Ken doll to me in my mind. He's a protagonist based on a military persona that got in, you know, decided they weren't going to take the chip implant either and went off grid to help support Cyanthea in her mission in the Blue Ridge Mountains. And he's sort of her protector, becomes her second husband. I didn't really have him based on anybody except for like who would be the ideal second husband for a woman who's got two husbands at the same time, you know? And so it worked out like that. Allure is definitely a character I saw but never met at a party that Del Chai / Maine took me to in New York. And he was the head of the goth scene at the time. So they opened the front red velvet rope and let us in ahead of the line. And it was really impressive. And we went in and I noticed this gal standing at the other side of the room. She was like 6 feet tall without shoes on. She was wearing 6 inch stilettos. So that made her 6'6". And without clothes on, on. I'm guessing she weighed about 130 pounds. So she had this skin tight vinyl outfit on and she looked like a ghoul. And so I knew she did it on purpose, then just enhanced that look. So I characterized her, she's in the book as a lure, and she becomes Sai's very good friend and another, she's good with guns, especially AKs. So she ends up being sort of one of her side agents protecting her as well. So those characters, they came from either people I saw or people I actually met at the Defense Department forensics labs. I didn't even make any secret. Instead of Jim Christie, his name is Chris James. He approved the message. He's read it, liked it. So lots of people. And then there's some CISOs too that are under the gun in towards the second, maybe two thirds into the book. One of them actually gets shot down. So I'm showing that, you know, you think that CISOs are just sitting behind a keyboard, you're doing their thing, but they are at risk. And especially if there's some kind of cyber war going on, why not take out the opposing talent, right? So that kind of stuff comes up again and again. And almost all of them, I'd say three quarters of them, are based on people I've met in the industry.
Wow, amazing. And that really, I think, contributes to the verisimilitude. And so nice of you to check with them too in advance, so that there wasn't, somebody wasn't saying to Hobbit, hey, there's a hacker guy that doesn't wear shoes. This could be you. So he right.
That's so, why I wanted to make sure he didn't have a freak out when he read the book. You know, right. Yeah.
This is only the first one in a trilogy, right? Is it possible for you to give us a sneak peek into where the story's going?
Yes. So in book number one, it's all about taking down Globecom's data centers and satellite communications. And that's just so they can cripple its hold on humanity. They didn't completely kill the company. They got close. So in book two, they're cleaning up the mess of what's left behind. But the problem is what's left behind is Damien, the key bad guy. And he's still up to his old tricks. He's trying to rebuild Globecom. There's a new AI that was in development beforehand that's going to make it a lot easier to scoop information on everybody on the planet. And you won't need a lot of data centers to do it. So how are the hackers going to deal with that? They're actually joining forces with someone who used to be the son of a Globecom board member. And originally I thought he was going to end up being the next bad guy, but once I started writing him, he turned out to be rather a good guy. And so there was no motivation for him to remain a bad guy once things were unveiled that Damien killed his mother and his father. And so then he turns his anger against Damien and they start using the AI to try to find him in their first test case of using a new AI. And that's all I'm going to say.
Oh, wow. This book sounds amazing. I hope our listeners are also already craving to read it. It is fascinating. So I hope that I heard that it's going to be sold at the RSA conference, which is probably a treat for anyone going as well. So thank you so much, Deb, for this.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you all our audience for being with us today on this fascinating episode. We've got a special treat for you. An autographed copy of Deb's book will be sent to the first person who can answer this question. What is the name of Deb's first cybersecurity article that was published by Byte Magazine in 1996? If you think you can find it, email your answer to youreverydaycyber@securitycurve.com. The first correct answer wins the book. Please follow the podcast and continue to get involved. You can reach out to us on Twitter @cyber_everyday. We're on LinkedIn if you wish to send us some questions in advance or suggest a topic. And our podcast page has more details from you and resources from each and every episode, plus a calendar of upcoming topics you might be interested to listen to. So thank you everyone for tuning in and stay safe out there.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of Your Everyday Cyber Podcast with Limor and Diana. If you learned something new and this conversation made you think, then share ITSPmagazine.com with your friends, family, and colleagues. If you represent a company and wish to associate your brand with our conversations, sponsor one or more of our podcast channels. We hope you will come back for more stories and follow us on our journey. You can always find us at the intersection of technology, cybersecurity, and society.